You may be seated. I think the Chief Justice must have shorter legs than I do.
Good morning. Welcome to the Court of Appeals. As noted, my name is John Rodenberg. I'm presiding today. With me are Chief Judge Cleary and Judge Larkin. We have four oral matters on the calendar this morning, the first of which is Thumper Pond Resort et al. Versus Badger Midwest et al. It's my understanding that respondents counsel are going to split time equally. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All right. And I've instructed the marshal to just put 15 minutes up. He'll stop it at 7:30. I'll let you know. If there are some additional questions, just as would happen with appellant's argument, we might extend it a little bit, but we're going to try and hold to the 7.5 each. Each side will have 15 minutes for principal argument. Appellant, of course, will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. The podium is adjustable. I can't say exactly how, but there's a little toggle switch down there. When you begin your comments, give your name and the party you represent so that we have that for the recording. Whenever appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Adina Bergstrom. May it please the court, counsel. I represent Thumper Pond Resort on this appeal. We are asking this court to reverse a grant of summary judgment by the trial court with respect to Badger, who was the developer for this particular project, and with respect to Integrity Insurance, who was the insurer for Gorski, who was the framer on the project. Summary judgment should be reversed because the court ignored genuine issues of material fact and it erred in its application of the law in dismissing these parties. This particular lawsuit arose from the collapse of the Thumper Pond Resort up in Otter Tail County, Minnesota in 2015. That resort was built in 2006. Relevantly,
and was built by a different organization, as I understand the state of things.
That is correct. My client was not the initial owner of the property. They subsequently came to own it later on down the road. But back in 2006, when
Badger... What was the date of acquisition by Thumper Pond?
I would have to look through my facts, Your Honor.
Construction was complete, though?
Construction was complete at the time, and it was operational at the time when they purchased it. So they were not part of the original construction of the property. During original construction, relevantly, in the spring of 2006, is when the roof truss system was assembled and was put together on the building. And that is when the damages at issue and the problems at issue first actually began, per the expert reports in this case.
And that work was done by this subcontractor, Gorski, is that correct?
Correct. There were a number of contractors that worked on the project. Badger was the developer that also did some on-site supervising, coordinating construction work as the developer. And Gorski served as the framer, and they actually installed this truss system, which is a very complex system of putting in proper nails, making sure the plates line up, et cetera, because you have very large spans on these truss systems.
Counsel, may I correct that the damages involved here involve only the damages to the building and there are no personal injuries?
There were no personal injuries by act of God, Your Honor. The park was open 2 hours prior to the collapse, and it was luckily empty at the time that the building ultimately catastrophically collapsed in 2015. I'm going to start first with the insurance issues in this case. In terms of the insurance that Integrity offered to Gorski, as I mentioned, Gorski was the framer on the property. Subsequent to the summary judgment motion, there was default judgment that was taken against Gorski that entered judgment on the merits. That is important because it determined a number of things that can now not be reopened and relitigated under Parr versus Gonzalez. Of importance is, number one, the documentation admissions through that default judgment that there was damage beginning in the spring of 2006. Damage in the form of cracking and buckling. And there appears to be some disconnect between engineering jargon and the interface on the insurance policy. And what I mean by that is engineers like to use words like buckling and creep and loss of tensile strength. And when you break that down to its plain meaning, what it means is that damage was occurring. Creep means loss of tensile strength, which reworded is breakage of wood fibers. That is property damage under the terms of the insurance policy. And that's important because in this court's de novo review of the insurance coverage, meaning you don't have to give any deference to how the trial court looked at it, property damage is key because you need, under a two-step process under Atten versus Scottsdale, you need an occurrence and you need property damage. And to some extent in the construction defect, those two concepts overlap. An occurrence happens when there is unintentional faulty construction combined with some damage. You don't need all of the damage. You don't need catastrophic damage. You need some damage. Versus, and that's set forth in Domtar versus Niagara Fire Insurance and cases that then followed. In 2006, we have documentation from Crane Engineering, and that's on page in the Crane Engineering affidavit that's included in our addendum, that clearly sets forth that you have damage to the framing members beginning in spring of 2006 that was admitted in that default judgment. The coverage offered under the integrity policy is very clear. It covers physical injury.
Is there an insurance policy that's clear, counsel?
I believe that there is an insurance policy that is clear in terms of the primary coverage. Are there other ambiguities in other portions of the policy? Potentially. But the law is pretty clear in terms of what this policy language covers for property damage. The policy itself contains a definition of what property damage is, and it's physical injury to tangible property. That's fairly straightforward. And if you look under the case law in Minnesota, what constitutes physical injury to tangible property is actually broadly read. By way of example, this court, in the case of United Sugars Corp., That case didn't involve buildings. It didn't involve construction defects. It involved what the FDA termed adulterated sugar. You had sugar that was contaminated by cigarette butts and bee parts. And the insurer came in and said, well, that's not physical damage. And this court said, no, it is. Direct physical loss can exist without actual destruction of the property or structural damage to property. It is sufficient to show that the insured property was injured in some way. So it's a broad concept, is my point, to find that coverage under the policy, which should be read in a light where reasonably you can do so, in favor of the insured. And in this particular instance, that would be Gorski. And, you know, in terms of the property damage that occurred, where the trial court went wrong was that the trial court basically included language in the policy that wasn't there. That said, you know what, there's only property damage in 2015 when the building actually went down. First of all, at that time, that disregarded the opinions of the experts. So right there, we have genuine issues of material fact that warrant reversal.
Did the policy expired in September of 2006, did it not?
That is correct.
If we went back in time and looked at, and I think I agree with you, there is evidence in the record of some creep and whatever before September of 2006. If we went back at that point in time, wouldn't it just be that the loss, to the extent there was one at that point, was the work itself?
No, and here's why, Your Honor, because you have to look at the work that, number one, was performed by the particular contractor, and I'm going to back up even one more step. I think what you're alluding to is the your work exclusion under the policy. That's an argument that was never made at the trial court level. I've argued it in my briefs, and I will submit again today. They don't get to raise that argument now on appeal. Their sole argument at the trial court level was the property damage occurred in 2015, which is outside of our policy limits, which is how the court gets into sing-saws and some of these other cases that deal with when the property damage occurs. So they never argued the your work exclusion. But to get to that point, if this court is inclined to even consider that question, your work would be limited to, let's back up to 2006, and we had discovered, oops, this was put together wrong. The cost of going back and fixing the installation work that Gorski performed, because that was solely its work. It didn't manufacture the trusses, it didn't manufacture the custom plates, it didn't put together the rest of the building. It just assembled the trusses. So that's its work that it, you'd have to limit it to. There was damage to the truss system itself. That was not part of Gorski's work. It was only installing. So look at it in this scenario. If 2006, they knew there was a problem, and they had hired a different contractor to come in and just basically redo Gorski's work and put in the proper nails, make sure that they use the right ones, make sure they hit all the plates, that would make, that potentially would not be covered unless you use subcontractors, and then you get into an exception to that rule. But here what we have is we've got damage to other work and to other property.
And it's your contention that the policy at that point in time would have covered the replacement of the truss, for example.
It would have covered the cost to address damage to any other property at that point in time. In my example, that would be the trusses. And I think that because of it, if that scenario existed in 2006, the numbers would obviously look very different and the analysis would be different. But under Parr versus Gonzalez and the Genoff case and Domtar, which talk about these different triggers and which insurers are on the risk, what we need to look at now is not just because we've got a discrete identifiable event, meaning faulty roofing work that led to damage, you don't just look at, hey, what happened during the policy period? You look at, was there damage to trigger coverage?
Well, counsel, that raises a question.
Yes.
You have a one-year policy, expires in 2006. It's occurrence-based. When does the liability for the insurance company end? What if it's collapsed in 2030, would they still be on the hook? Is that what you're suggesting?
What I'm suggesting is if that's when the damage was found, and that is when, I mean, you taking into account statute of limitations and setting all of that aside for a
right.
moment,
yes.
under the discrete, if when you have a discrete identifiable event, so you've got damage arising from something very discrete, and that's admitted in this case, and that's what the court found at the trial court level that hasn't been challenged. The law says that insurer is on the risk for all of the damage. And Parr versus Gonzalez is very clear on that point. And the Domtar case really talks about the difference between discrete identifiable event and when you have pro rata time on the risk. So you have multiple, so you have damage occurring over a certain amount of time. You don't know what caused the damage specifically. You don't know how to divide out the damage and whether in a continuous situation. In that scenario, you would use pro rata time on the risk where the different insurers various scope of coverage and liability is divided up depending how long the damage went on, time on the risk, et cetera. That was not argued in this case, and that's not what the court decided. The court decided that we have a discrete identifiable event, and that leaves the insurer who is on the risk of the time of initial damage on the hook for the entire amount of damage. And Parr versus Gonzalez, I know I keep going back to that case, but it's such a great example of the law, and it's very clear when the court describes it in that case. In that case, you had coverage for a three-month period, okay, between essentially May and July. During that three-month time frame, you had roofing work that was done to the home. Contractor comes out, and it dents a vent. Later, what happens is water comes in, mold develops sometime down the road after the furnace is turned on in the fall. Policy is no longer in effect. Eventually, homeowners find out that they have damage and they have an issue and bring their suit. And the court comes back and says, insurer, you're on the hook for the entire $600,000 it cost to demo and rebuild that home, even though the initial damage may have started very small. And that's because of the discrete identifiable event, and it's called the actual injury trigger rule in Minnesota.
So an occurrence-based policy, if your client had had another policy that it had signed off on in, say, 2014, 2015, so it covered the date of the failure. Are you saying both insurers would be on the hook?
I'm sorry, you're talking
about... Okay, you have a new insurer who comes in, and the place has been up there for 15 years or 13 years, whatever it is, and now they're going to insure the premises, and it's an occurrence-based policy also, and it collapses while they have a policy. Are they in the hook for the whole thing or just part of it?
Right. And if, are we talking about the insurer for Gorski, or are we talking about a different type of insurance?
No, I'm talking about your client. You have a policy.
So first-party insurance. Yes. So that's going to be subject to a completely different analysis because that's a first-party contract. Is there potential cover there, coverage there? There might be. And but that's a first-party collapse coverage. If there's any overlapping coverages or issues with that, then that's worked out between the insurers behind the scenes in a subrogation or contribution action. It doesn't go to the merits of whether or not Integrity in this particular scenario has a responsibility under its CGL to indemnify for Gorski's the default judgment against Gorski.
But the first party with the occurrence policy, in your opinion, would have a claim against Integrity under those facts?
Potentially. I mean, so it's not uncommon for, you know, first party insurers, if they pay out on a claim and someone else is responsible for the damage they've paid out on, they've got the right to do a subrogation action or to go back for contribution.
Well, I understand that, but I'm talking about an occurrence-based policy, and the occurrence has now occurred.
Yes.
And you're still saying that from 14 years earlier, a one-year policy, that Integrity would be on the hook?
Absolutely, it would be. And that's not me. That is what the law in Minnesota says, because we've got a discrete identifiable event. And that's really what it comes down to. You've got a difference in rules depending on how that is termed. And because we have some very important undisputed facts in this case, that's why I can say with such clarity that they are responsible for all of the damage that develops under Parr versus Gonzalez. You know, in terms of the application of SingSaws, I just want to mention that I believe this is where the court got off track. SingSaws involved a situation where you had an elevator shaft that was not properly worked on or maintained that resulted in a bodily injury, a personal injury, when it injured an employee after the policy period expired. What's important is that you've got the faulty work and the damage all occurring. The damage needs to occur within the policy period. And that's where I think the court got off track at the trial court level when they were using and applying the SingSaws case. The principle of law is in and of itself correct. It's just that that case is very factually distinguishable from what we have in this particular instance.
Time is running short.
Oh, my apologies. So we would ask this court to reverse the grant of summary judgment both to Badger and to Integrity and to remand back to the district court. Badger did owe a duty of care under the law set forth in the rules for duty of a care of a professional, as we did have an expert affidavit on that issue. It so should be remanded for trial on the negligence against Badger, and it should be remanded to the trial court for entry of judgment against Integrity Mutual, finding coverage under the policy for the judgment against Gorski, and an order for Integrity to release its policy proceeds to partially satisfy that judgment.
And you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Respondents?
Good morning. If it pleases the court and counsel, I'm George Hottinger, and I'm here arguing on behalf of Integrity Mutual Insurance Company. This is where I'd like to begin. At the trial court, the judge was asked to find an occurrence based on a continuous trigger claim. The trial court was asked to find that the occurrence really was a fact issue. And what the jury had to decide was the collapse in 2015? Was that the accident under the definition of the policy? Or was the policy, specifically the definition that accident includes, or an occurrence includes, a continuous ongoing exposure to some harmful events? The trial court found as a matter of law that the accident under the policy, the occurrence, was the discrete event, the roof collapse in 2015, and the Integrity policy, which was not in effect, would not apply. And I would like to go to a question of Judge Cleary, which I think is going to help illustrate what the trial judge found. Judge Cleary asked, well, what if you had an occurrence-based policy? And really, I take that question as in the context of a third-party case. What if you have a liability policy that would have been in effect, you say in 2014, I think that was your example, Judge.
A Gorski policy.
Yeah, let's say it's the policy at that time that was issued by to Gorski, and Gorski's policy is in effect. At that point in time, that collapse under the policy would be that unexpected happening, that accident, that discrete event, as defined by the policy, accompanied by damage, the collapse at that time. That policy would be implicated. I also think that the question of Judge Cleary is very helpful from the standpoint of the Parr case. You now, on appeal, we have a new theory that could have been advanced at the trial court level and was not. The new theory that you're now being asked to consider, and that wasn't presented to the trial court, is this. You're now being asked to consider that the discrete identifiable event was the installation of the trusses and that the truss work was completed in spring of 2006. And then that caused damage. And that should be viewed as the discrete identifiable event, the accident under the policy. Well, let's put aside the fact that that wasn't submitted to the trial court when it could have. But let's look at the Parr case and how it's instructive. First, please look at document number 95. Document number 95 is an unrebutted affidavit. That affidavit lays out that Comstock Construction was engaged by Cash Hagen as the framer and the entity to put in the trusses. That work, as represented to this court in the appellant's brief, was done and completed in the spring of 2006. Document number 95, that affidavit, clarifies and sets forth unequivocally that Comstock was doing that work. Comstock was also named in this case, and the allegations against them were that they improperly erected the trusses. Gorski was off the site.
Comstock took the place of Gorski.
Correct. Comstock
predecessor took the predecessor owner, as I understand the file, required Gorski out, Comstock in.
Precisely. And the predecessor owner discharged Gorski from the site. They were off no later than February of 2005. Comstock comes on board. And Comstock then completes the framing and installs the truss work.
The policy in question started in September of 2005, did it?
Correct. And so the policy itself, and this is what is instructive from the Parr case, the policy has to be in effect when the work is taking place. So here, the integrity policy didn't begin until September of 2005. Gorski was not on the site then. They were not doing any work. Comstock was doing that work. Had that claim or that argument been made at the trial level, of course, it would have been rejected there as it should be rejected here if the court's going to allow it. So the other thing about Parr that has to be satisfied, you not only have to have the work itself, if it's going to be the discrete identifiable event, the work has to take place within the policy period, which it did not. Moreover, you have to have, at that time, you have to have damage to other property. If you look at the Parr case, there, the damage to other property was the mold that developed. And the mold that developed started during the policy period. So here we have another difference. The claim here is that the damage, and I'll speak to that in a little bit, just putting aside whether it is damage, what's been represented is that the damage itself started in the spring of 2006. Again, the integrity policy at that point in time, as far as damage, unlike the claim in Parr, there is no damage to the truss itself, as Judge Rodenberg was inquiring about earlier. I just want to say that I'll rely on our brief from the standpoint of the appeal issues, but the All this argument, this is a collateral attack on a legal conclusion of the court. The default judgment does not create anything to appeal from. The adverse finding to the appellant here was the legal conclusion that the occurrence was the roof collapse in 2015. And I think I want to just say a couple of things about the Singsass case, which is very instructive. Because although it's a personal injury case, the grant of coverage, that is, what an occurrence, it depends on an occurrence causing property damage or personal injury. The analysis is the same. And in the Singsass case,
Steve, would you hit the pause? We're at the time, and I do have a question on that. It seems like in that case where the elevator, this thing lets loose, I can't remember what that's called. There's some funny.
Well, there's an elevator shaft.
Yeah, but there's the connector.
Yeah, the connector degraded.
That broke loose. Was there evidence in that case that the connector was damaged before the date of the fall?
The argument was, as the argument was here at the lower court, is that the degradation itself, there was an ongoing process of degradation which weakened that connector. And then that should have been a contributing factor to the elevator falling. And there was a fact issue. The court rejected that argument as that's the actual event. The accident.
The occurrence.
The occurrence itself is the collapse of the shaft. Whereas, just as in this case, the accident, the event, is the collapse of the roof. What was argued at the lower court was not that this buckling, this deflection, which was intermingled with things in the environment, chemical, air, snow on the roof, all of that, was being set forth as this degradation, ongoing deflection. There wasn't any argument that that in and of itself was damage. Another new argument. It looks like I'm out of time.
Time is up, but let me see if my colleagues have any questions. It seems they have none. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Michael Sharkey, and I represent Badger Midwest Holdings in this case. Plaintiff's appeal is based on a flawed understanding of the district court's order, and there's effectively three issues before this court. Contrary to the appellant's erroneous assertions in their briefing, Judge Senek did not find that there was no developer duty in Minnesota. That's not at all what he found. What he found is that under the specific facts and circumstances of this case, there's no developer duty. And we can go to the conclusion of Judge Senek's order, page 21, quote, because the record is entirely lacking in the specific facts required to show that Badger owed any legally recognized duty of care to plaintiff's cause of action for negligence fails as a matter of law, and Badger has no liability. So appellant is attempting to frame something that simply isn't in the court's order. Second thing I'd like to just quickly hit, and then I'll get back to the meat and bones of that, is that plaintiff claims that the court made its ruling sua sponte. That's erroneous, too. Plaintiff appellant would have you believe that there was some surprise about the briefing on the issue of breach of duty, or duty and breach of duty for a developer. Page 1. Paragraph 1 of Badger Midwest Holdings' motion for summary judgment discusses breach of duty and duty for a developer. And for that matter, we all know back from law school, first year, that there are four elements of negligence. And the only thing pled by the appellant in this case is negligence. And so therefore, they are on notice that they would have to put on some kind of explain the duty to the court and what the breach of duty is. And by the way, and we've briefed this, I don't think we need to get into it under the patent factors, but the trial court is allowed to, even if this was a sua sponte holding, the trial court's allowed to do that. And finally, there's the, and I don't think it's a real big issue, I don't want to spend a great deal of time unless the court wants to, but we have the motion to compel issue. Thumper Pond would have you believe that Badger engaged in some nefarious scheme to hold back records, but that's simply not true. What we know is this: Bjorn Koshhagen looked for records. That's in his testimony. And he said that the CPA for Badger told him destroy records after 10 years. I personally spoke with corporate counsel. He had nothing for Badger.
Is that in the record?
That was, I discussed that before the trial court. I don't have an affidavit from myself. There,
I didn't see any record of that.
It was discussed before the trial court. That's all I can say about that, Your Honor, is that I did speak to corporate counsel. He didn't have anything. Ryan Gamble, that affidavit is in the record. He doesn't have any records. And then, and this is the curious part, Robert Ream also gave us an affidavit saying that the only records he had were a couple of letters from 2006. Well, we were put on notice, and Thumper Pond talks a lot about the notice issue of when the claim was made. They were put on notice in 2015. So we have records, those couple of letters, which have to do with payment, really, from 2006, less than 10 years.
It was sort of a dispute about payment at that time, was there not?
It was a dispute about, the idea was Badger was only paid one half of its original fee,
and then
because Badger only did one half of the work for the franchise.
Seems like there's a question about whether the Badger should have gotten an equity stake and what.
They gave up their equity stake, and those are in the letters too, as because they only did the first half of the franchising work. But anyway, when we get to that 10-year from the CPA, and again, Bjorn Koshhagen discussed this, everything that's more than 10 years from the time of notice, 2015 to 2005, the records from 2004 when Badger was involved, those are gone. So it's not surprising. I would like to, if the court doesn't mind, I'd like to get into the meat and potatoes of the actual issue concerning Judge Sinek's findings. Under the specific facts of this case, he couldn't find any developer duty. And that shouldn't surprise us, because appellant's brief doesn't find anything either. If we go through the cases, Pond Hollow case, Pond Hollow v. Ryland Group, first of all, that case involves a developer and general contractor. Ryland acted as both. That is not what Badger was. I'm sure the appellant will concede that KSI was a general contractor. Furthermore, unlike this case, which was only pled in negligence, that case concerned breach of warranties and breach of contract. Those are not issues here.
Well, they can't be, because Thumper Pond has no contract with Badger.
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. It is curious, though, that in the Ryland decision, at page 924, the court holds that in order to show that the developer has a duty, you have to articulate, quote, a quote, precise duty, end quote, and that just articulating a standard of care is not enough. That's the one part of the Pond Hollow case that I would say is relevant to what we are at here today. If you look at the Highland Hill North Condominium Association case, there is a developer. It doesn't actually have anything to do with the developer's role and duty. Just the developer shows up in that case. If you look at the Clifton Place case, that was decided under the Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act. Has nothing to do with this. And in there, the developer hired a bunch of the entities that worked on the case, or worked on the project. Again, nothing like what we have with Badger. And then finally, the North Main Association v. Franchoux. In the Franchoux case, number one, it was, and I'm probably going to say this wrong, an M. Kiowa case. That's the Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act case. It's a very specific statute. It's MnStat 514B concerning condominiums with multiple different owners. That has nothing to do with this, the present facts. And also, in that case, Franchoux hired the architect and hired the contractor. Again, not what we have here. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the court may have, seeing as how my time is running low.
If
Appears we have none. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
And Ms. Bergstrom, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time. My guess was that you would.
Thank you. I'm going to address the Badger issues that were just raised by respondent. The court did state in its order that it did not, there was no duty of care for a developer, and that is patently wrong under Minnesota law. In the Pond Hollow case that counsel has just tried to distinguish from the facts in this particular case, those distinguishments are actually not quite as wide as counsel would have you believe. Pond Hollow, in that particular case, number one, the court did apply essentially civil jury instruction 80.75, which is the duty of care of professionals in the context of a developer. That is the duty of care. And in the Pond Hollow case, that case actually ended up getting dismissed in terms of the developer because the expert affidavit did not set forth with enough specificity what the duty of care was. That's not like this case. And I will point this court's direction to page 68 of our addendum, which is our expert affidavit. At paragraphs 20 and 21, the expert sets forth what the duty of care is for a developer who is similarly situated to Badger and how they breached that duty of care. So there was sufficient evidence in the record, at least creating a material fact issue on that question as to whether or not there's a breach. And we did meet the standard in terms of the legal duty to present whether a duty was owed or not. So the court erred in that regard and erred by disregarding Pond Hollow. The last comment on that case is, in Pond Hollow, Ryland did act as both the developer and the general contractor. Here, we've got Badger and KSI, which are owned by the same gentleman, Mr. Koshhagen. He just gave them two different names. So we've got a similar situation where we have a potential master-servant situation, which, of course, is also a question of fact. The court erred in granting summary judgment to Badger, finding no duty and disregarding genuine issues of material fact on whether or not they breached that duty and were ultimately negligent. And the record does speak for itself on that particular issue. The briefs also speak to the fact that this was a sua sponte ruling. There was no argument that a developer doesn't owe a duty of care, and that would be incorrect in light of the law that we have in Minnesota that says that they do.
The argument below seemed to be about whether Badger was or was not a developer.
Right, factually, whether they were or were not a developer, and that's correct. That was the entire basis of the argument going in. So for the trial court to then rule, we can't find a case that says that they have any duty of care, is wrong under Minnesota law, because that's a professional standard that we have a jury instruction for, and we've got facts showing it was met in this case. So it's a fact issue, and it should not have been thrown out on summary judgment, and a reversal is required. Final quick comments on the integrity arguments, if this court has no further questions on the Badger Mutual.
I actually do have one further question.
Yes.
On the Badger thing. And
yes.
It relates to the discovery question and your argument to the district court and
yes.
Now that there ought to be a spoliation sanction.
Correct.
Factually, do we agree that all of the existing documents have been produced?
Factually, we don't, I mean, it appears that there has been, I'm going to accept counsel's representations as true. We don't have a full record on that issue because the deposition transcript of Mr. Koshhagen was he hadn't checked with all of his partners and he didn't check with all of his partners at the time he was placed on notice of this potential collapse when he was still in business. So I think that if we accept that all of the documentation.
Senex seems to have analyzed it as if you agree that all of the existing documents have been produced and that it was a spoliation question, not a compelled discovery question.
Right. And that was my assumption in reading it as well. We brought the motion to compel because we weren't satisfied that the corporation had done its due diligence in asking its partners for information. However, if the court, so number one, that's where we're saying the court erred. They should have issued an order saying you need to go check with all of your partners, issue affidavits saying if they don't have anything, they don't.
So you're arguing both.
Correct.
Both that it was error not to compel and that it was error not to apply spoliation sanctions.
Correct. At least they need to analyze what the proper remedy is for spoliation sanctions. I mean, that's a mandate under Patton versus Newmar and under Miller versus Lankow. If there's spoliation that occurs, the court then does, they have to do some sort of analysis. What prejudice did that cause? What's the appropriate remedy for that prejudice? And the court didn't do that based on a reasoning that we, who didn't have the documents, couldn't show that there would have been anything helpful in those documents. That's not the standard, and that's an impossible standard because, frankly, I don't have a crystal ball. So that's why the law requires the court to weigh out what's the prejudice here and how do we remedy that. So we're asking the court to remand on that issue as well for abuse of discretion.
Any additional questions? All right, thank you. The matter is submitted. We thank counsel for your briefing and argument. We will have our decision issued within 90 days. Thank you. The allergies are a little later than usual this year.
I was confused initially,
too.
But it wasn't worth getting into.
Got it.